When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 167.
On today's show, we talk about Pueblo Bonito, Australian settlers, and dogs in Jamestown.
Let's dig a little deeper into that dog thigh when we're cold and starving and hungry in the wintertime.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, no. That got dark fast.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome to the show. How's it going?
Pretty good.
Freezing cold.
I know. I'm like here in my sweatshirt, zipped all the way up with a heated blanket on my lap and slippers. Like, what happened? We came to Oregon and found winter.
I know. It's April.
Yeah.
What is going on? In fact, it hailed today so much so that for a little while before it melted,
It
looked like snow.
Yeah, it did.
All over the place.
Yep.
And all I was thinking was our brand new solar panels on top of the roof are just getting pounded.
Pounded by hail. I hope they're okay.
Little weather pebbles.
I hope they're hail proof, but who knows?
I mean, it depends on the hail. A lot of hail is like really soft. It's just like formed up and not really.
This looked like pretty soft hail, so I think we're probably okay.
Didn't sound like soft hail. Well, speaking of weather destroying stuff, Let's talk about Pueblo Bonito.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. There were some good articles in Plus One the last couple of weeks, and there's always good articles in Plus One.
Yeah.
And we've got actually two from there. This first one is called The Deterioration of the Pueblo Bonito Great House in the Chaco Culture National Historic Park, New Mexico, USA, by Henry L. Short. Published on April 5th, 2022.
Nice.
All right. So the long and the short of this is, first off, we've talked about Chaco Canyon.
Yeah, we did just recently in a Timelines episode where we were looking at the different cultures in North America at the same time.
Yeah.
So, and Chaco was one of them.
Yeah. Go find that episode because I'm not going to do all the links again. There's a whole series of links to other APN podcasts and sources about Chaco because there was a whole Site Bites, which is a little mini series. About Chaco Canyon. So you can search Site Bites. You can go to archpodnet.com. Type in Chaco Canyon on the main page there.
It's like so much will come up.
Chaco
is just a wonderful thing to talk about. And it comes up so often and people are always doing research there. So there's just so much to know about Chaco.
Right. So Chaco, to remind you, dates from 850 to 1150 CE, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
And the great houses there, like Pueblo Bonito, the one we're going to talk about, were built of quarried sandstones, wooden timbers, and mud mortar.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So were they looking at like the actual like structures themselves in this study? Like what were they... Yeah, what were they doing?
Yeah, so this guy, Henry Short, who I didn't really look for much information on, but Plus One doesn't really give much about the author either.
They'll just give you like a link to like an email or something, basically.
Yeah, there's not even that really that I can see. So anyway, he did an examination, essentially, of some Chacoan photographs, right?
Okay.
And when I say some, I mean about 4,150 of Pueblo Bonito alone.
There are that many pictures?
Of just Pueblo Bonito.
Wow.
Pueblo Bonito is the massive, large great house that is really close to the visitor center. If you ever visit Chaco Canyon, it's right down there in the canyon, right front and center. And it's kind of where you come in. You see it right away.
Yeah, it's super big and it's like one of the focal points of visiting. Yeah. And when we went about 10 years ago, you could walk all the way through it and take pictures and do everything. So I guess for this study, there probably were like tons of pictures to examine.
So this current study, as I mentioned, based on photographs, the author and if Plus One, all the articles are open source. So you can go there and go through
it. Read the whole thing. Yeah.
He has a link in the article really early on to the collection of photographs you can look at online.
Mm.
Right. So these photographs that he looked at were taken between 1887 and roughly the 1920s.
So 4,000 pictures were taken of Pueblo Bonito from 1887 to the 1920s.
Yeah.
That's so many pictures in a time when owning a camera wasn't even common.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's a lot.
Yeah.
He tried to determine if structural damages depicted on the photographs could either be attributed to identifiable agents that might have been present when Pueblo Bonito was occupied or to something that was like taking place or happening after it was abandoned.
Okay, so whether the issues with the structure were caused by the people who lived in them or by something that happened after they were abandoned.
And not like they're looking at something that happened 900 years ago, like, oh, this is still broken 900 years ago. But the ongoing deterioration of the structure, is it problems they also had to deal with?
Oh.
Not like somebody came in and knocked a wall down 200 years after they left it.
Okay.
It's like while they were living there, is the damage we're seeing today consistent with what they would have dealt with on a daily basis?
Like what does erosion do to a wall over 40 years today? Is that the same kind of erosion they would have been dealing with in the, you know, 1000s and 1100s when they were living there?
When they're like living in it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
And it's funny you say erosion because that's kind of part of it, but not really.
Okay.
Yeah. So one likely agent, though, for, and agents are just things that do stuff.
Yeah, things that cause issues.
Right, from an anthropological sense. Mm-hmm. One likely agent is the inability, he said, for the ancestral Puebloan engineers, which I think inability and also saying the words engineers is adding a lot of inference to who built these things.
Yeah, and what they knew and didn't know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
To manage impacts of weather, a.k.a. the annual precipitation, was probably one likely cause of this deterioration. So now I want to talk about engineers for a second because he makes just an assumption with that one statement that there were people who were specialized in building this stuff. But it makes me kind of wonder, you know, you talk about like Plains Indians with their teepees and, you know, other Native Americans, other groups around the world with the structures that they built. It's like you don't have people going off to work and doing different things. You don't have you don't have people sitting around watching Netflix and playing video games all day and living off government paychecks. You got to live and survive. And I have to imagine that like a lot of people had the knowledge of how to maintain your home.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like most people who live in a house today know how to sweep it out and keep the floor clean. I feel like back in the day, it would have been like, okay, so I'm going to sweep it out, keep the floor clean and repair this wall.
Right.
Like, I don't think they would have had to call somebody in, especially to repair the wall.
Maybe not to repair, but the initial building of the structure, they must have had people who specialized in the techniques.
Well, we'll talk about that.
At least because of the uniformity in the types of structures that you see. So somebody was directing how they were done, probably.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. Not necessarily, though. Yeah. So another thing, another agent of, I guess, destruction would have obviously been wood deterioration.
Oh, sure.
And now we were there. Wood planks were used for, what is it, like window and door frame?
Like the lintels?
Yeah, that's what we're looking for, over the top. Mm-hmm. And then also for like structural components in between floors. Because Pueblo Bonito is 3, 4, sometimes 5 stories high, depending on where you're looking at it.
Yeah, and like if you can imagine like an adobe structure, you'd see the end of the, not planks so much as like large branches or almost.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they were cut pieces of wood, you know, whatever they were. But
you would see them sticking out of the floor as like a, almost like a temper for the floor, kind of.
Exactly. And they had no way to treat this wood.
Yeah.
So depending on what they did prior to installing it into the structure, because I guess if you, I don't know, if you would have, you know, debarked it and let it sit out to, you know, cure or something like that, it would have like dried out with all its moisture and stuff. But I don't know at what point in time they put them into the structures, but it seemed pretty clear to this guy, for example, that when you're looking at these things, you know, it would take perhaps a couple decades for it to, you know, actually deteriorate. And then the wood would have to be replaced. That's just normal maintenance.
Yeah.
You know, wood just isn't going to last that long.
Yeah.
The wood that you can see currently in the structures is there because it is surrounded by a mud matrix.
So it basically like preserved the wood.
Well, kind of. It probably wouldn't have any good structural stability right now. It just retains its shape.
Oh, okay.
So if you were to go like stress it a little bit, it would probably just fall to pieces.
Probably would. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So another thing that could have happened, and again, due to water action, and I forgot to mention when I mentioned the annual precipitation, right now that's been measured for this time period because there's various ways of mm-hmm. looking at past precipitation rates.
Right.
I think I saw in the article it was about 200 millimeters a year.
Oh, okay.
Which is actually quite a bit.
Yeah, more that's more than you would think for like a high desert area.
Yeah, I think they kind of get it all at once.
Yeah, well, it might be snow too. Like they definitely got snow there, I'm sure. So, yeah.
For sure. So, looking at that water, he used some, in this article, some engineering terms. That water could have affected the mud mortar in a way that kind of unstabilized or destabilized the mud mortar, took some of it away, so to speak, and then created what they call unstable gravity load paths. So you've got big stones that are put together, bigger ones on underneath smaller ones.
Uh-huh.
The bigger ones were put into this mud mortar as kind of a base, and then the mud mortar was put in between them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, between the stones and the mortar, you've got, you know, again, they're not really engineers. They're not doing math, but to the best of their ability, they tried to put the bigger ones on the bottom, the smaller ones on the top. So mm-hmm. you have obviously not as much stress on smaller ones.
Right.
That being said, when the mortar would kind of deteriorate, it would shift things around a little bit and move them around and create what they call the unstable gravity load paths. And of course, the ancestral Puebloans would have known nothing about that, but they right. would have seen the effects of it pretty quickly.
Is it basically just like water runoff paths, basically? Like water would be running off the roof or the top of something, and it would generally go the same direction and wear out the mortar in the directions that it was running inconsistently, basically?
But I don't think these paths are tied to those paths. I think what he's talking about is the water would create its own path of least resistance and take mud mortar with it because it's water and it does that. But when it does that, it creates these, like if you were to structurally see with some sort of futuristic device, you know, mm-hmm. look into the rocks and stones and see where the pressure points are.
Mm-hmm.
As that mud deteriorates away, it would create different gravity, you know, points where gravity is affecting the stones in a way that, you know, causes them to incorrectly
to
load
be
themselves.
Unstable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah. So another thing that water would do is cause ponding of water, and ponding just means collecting water.
Mm-hmm.
So water would collect in different areas. And then if it does that and then the walls freeze
mm-hmm.
or it freezes where that is, mm-hmm. Obviously that could cause a blowout of certain wall segments.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay.
So, and then occasional full-scale flooding could have disrupted
sure.
the foundations
because
it happens.
Disrupt everything.
I mean, it's a canyon.
Yeah, and floods, they disrupt any structure no matter what time period you're talking about. So,
right.
Yeah.
Now, what he found at Pueblo Bonito is assumed to have happened at the other pueblos around,
mm-hmm.
although some of those weren't built quite to the scale that Pueblo Bonito was, so
right.
some of the weight requirements and things like that would have been different. But he did, you know, what I've talked about here are what the results of the study actually were. You know, that these things that he can see in the photographs, and I think he looked at that time period because there has been stabilization efforts since then.
Right, right.
Right? They've like added to them. So
yeah.
they're not in their original condition anymore like they were when these photographs were taken, or, mm-hmm. or at least the original discovered condition by
Europeans.
They
weren't so much into preserving them in the 1800s,
right.
early 1900s. It was more like a, ooh, look at this cool thing,
right.
not let's keep it from falling apart.
Yeah. Anyway, it's pretty clear that at Pueblo Bonito, this wasn't built as one thing like the pyramids, right? It was built over time
right.
as a collection of growing rooms.
Right.
Starting with like kivas, you know, like the mud underground, mud lined structures,
because mm-hmm.
there's kivas inside Pueblo Bonito, and then building on top of that, structures on top of that, and then continuing to climb structures on top of structures on top of structures,
right.
you know, floors. I think, like I said, up to five floors, I think I
yeah.
saw near the canyon wall, kind of descended out, probably used the wall partially as stability
yeah.
for that. But he says that given the volatility of the construction methods and how things would naturally just kind of fall apart, even if you're trying to take care of them,
mm-hmm.
that the lifetime of individually constructed rooms at Pueblo Bonito may have only been a couple of decades before they'd have to really structurally
redo
dismantle
it.
Something and redo it.
Which you know? Makes sense because I mean, it was there from 850 to 1150, I think.
Yeah, something
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
But, you know, with five floors and all the rooms that it has, I don't think it was like that for that whole 400-year chunk of time.
Oh, no. It was built upon.
Yeah. So
we're seeing it at the end of its life.
Exactly. So it makes sense that, you know, they were renovating floor two and, oh, hey, let's just throw on a floor three while we're doing that. So it sort of speaks to the natural, like, evolution of the size of the building that they had to do these renovations every couple decades. And then, you know, they probably added onto it at the same time. Why not? It's really cool.
Indeed. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a pretty cool study. And it just goes to show that, you know, while this is the archaeology show, sometimes archaeology is just looking at historical documents and records.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't do any digging.
Well, it's so interesting to think, what can these historical photographs show you that photos today won't show you because of preservation efforts?
Right.
It sucks to think of it, but because they didn't care about preservation 100 years ago, you might be able to get more information out of those photos than you can out of any photos or more modern, you know, images from today.
Yeah, well, this also goes to show you what the future effects of things you're doing today could have on an archaeological site, right? Mm-hmm. Like we call a full-scale investigation a data recovery. Mm-hmm. We don't call it artifact recovery. We don't call it feature recovery. No. We call it data recovery.
Yeah.
Because we're recovering data. We take what seems like nonsensical pictures of, you know, dirt walls and stuff like that And we sit there and we meticulously draw out mm-hmm. profiles and sketches and stuff like that. And sometimes it just seems, when you're out there, like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah, with that, like, you know, microscopic bit of data that you're collecting, it's yeah. like, why am
what
I doing
good is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we're taking photographs of everything and we're just meticulously recording this stuff, because as we're pulling these things out of the ground, it no longer exists.
Yeah, you're destroying the context.
Yeah, so you're destroying it.
You have to get all of the information you can out of it, because you don't know what future yeah. researchers might be able to discover about something.
Exactly. I mean, who knew 100 years plus ago, you know, 120 years ago, when they were taking these photos, that they would come in handy?
It'd be used for a study. Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
So,
and I love hearing about some sites, too, where they're purposely not excavating all of it and leaving some for the future. So future archaeologists have something to potentially discover if they have new techniques and are looking for new and different things.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Terracotta Army comes to mind immediately. They're purposely not excavating some of it, partly because of preservation issues, but also because save it for the future, because who knows what the future holds as far as technology goes.
Right. All right. Well, you know who really could have used a nice place to stay? The British colonists that landed in Australia in the mid-1800s.
Oh, good.
They had too much sunshine and not enough vitamin C. Back in a minute.
Wow.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 167. And we are now going to talk about another Plos One article, and it's called Health Effects of European Colonization, an Investigation of Skeletal Remains from 19th to Early 20th Century Migrant Settlers in South Australia. It's interesting saying South Australia, because Australia means South Land, but we'll get back to that in a minute.
Oh.
Yeah, so, and I suppose since this is about British colonists, I should say skeletal, because that's how they say it. Yeah, they're skeletons.
Oh my God.
No, skeletons. They say skeletons, but then it's skeletal.
Skeletal, right.
So I want to call them skeletons from now on.
Okay, it's worth that.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so researchers for this study analyzed the remains of British migrants from the site of an Anglican parish cemetery near Australia's southern coastline. The cemetery was actually in use from 1847 to 1927.
Okay. It's old.
Now, yeah, and when they were looking at the cemetery, amongst the people that they excavated and they analyzed bone and teeth enamel for vitamins, and, you know, you could just see what they were eating, see mm-hmm. what their health was, their general condition.
Yeah, your
condition.
Teeth can tell you so much. Yeah. So That's a big one to study when you're trying to figure out specific things about a population.
Exactly. Yeah. What they found overall were evidence of deficiencies in iron and some interesting levels of vitamins C and D.
Mm.
So there was actually more vitamin D found in the remains of the Australian people that were buried there versus their contemporaries buried in England.
Well, duh. Doesn't that make sense? I mean,
yeah.
Vitamin D comes from sunlight, and Australia, from what I understand, is a lot sunnier than England is.
It's pretty sunny.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, I don't think England even has sunshine. So that's,
right. Yeah. I've never been to either place, but
right,
I'm
right.
assuming.
In general as well, they also had lower levels of vitamin C as compared to those buried in Britain. And that's more attributed to
diet,
just nutrition.
Yeah. Because vitamin C is like your oranges and vegetables and things like that, right? So, yeah.
A couple other interesting things they found was that many of the, I guess, physiological changes that were seen occurred during the latter half of an individual's life in some of the cases.
Okay.
And in other cases, they showed some health stresses experienced by some during the fetal stage. So when they were, you know, in utero and then within the first 25 years of somebody's life. So what they kind of concluded from this, looking at the different ages of the people and when these people were buried and, you know, dating not only the ages, but like dating the remains themselves, was that the new colony was somewhat unprepared, right? And and people, when they first came to this colony, even after it was established, were also unprepared for the Southern Australian lifestyle.
Right.
And generally, when people came to this colony, they were, you know, not children. They were adults, so over 25 years old, and give or take, just for purposes of this study. Mm-hmm. And the increase of vitamin D, lack of vitamin C, lack of iron, showed that when they first got there, and I have a feeling that the journey itself wasn't too great either, but
you hear about sailors having a problem with scurvy, which is vitamin C. So if their vitamin C levels were lower than expected, that could be attributed to the lack of fresh vegetables on a sea, you know, crossing.
Yeah, for sure. But this just showed that once people got there, it was hard to live there.
Yeah.
Essentially, in the early days. It got better, which we'll see. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the people that were born there also had some harsher conditions. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of tell just by looking at the remains, somebody who was born there versus somebody who was not as well. Because you can see the teeth are like layers. Right. You can look back through the teeth by looking at the layers of enamel on the teeth. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see what happened early on in their life and then later on in their life as well. So that's kind of neat.
It's interesting that they're able to draw conclusions about like fetal conditions from their adult teeth.
Well, that's not true because your baby teeth fall out, so they're different teeth.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I guess
I don't know. I mean, the only thing I can come up with you know, fetal to 25 years old is they have actual burials that are young.
Oh, I see. Okay,
that's the only, because so they didn't really talk about that much, at least in the parts I read.
So they have some child burials, and then they're able more to draw than likely conclusions. Yeah. I mean, of course, obviously, infant mortality is a thing.
For sure.
So there probably were a lot of young burials. Got it.
Exactly. And with this relatively new colony, well, at least new for Australia, one of the other things they were able to determine with this excavation and analysis was the economic status of the migrants through time as they went along. Part of the reason was, I mean, this is a British cemetery. I mean, it's an Anglican parish cemetery, but let's be honest, this is a British cemetery pretty much run and owned by the British government.
Right.
And you know, there was like the nice part and then there was the free part.
Oh, yeah.
They wouldn't. I mean, they were not so callous as to say, you know, if you're poor, you can't be buried here because religion was king. Mm-hmm. But or queen.
Well, the best parts of the cemetery were saved for the people that could afford it, basically.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But one of the things that they noticed is that, you know, while this was initially used in the 1840s, from about the 1870s onward, things were starting to get better there because more and more people were becoming prosperous, as indicated by their diet, and is also indicated by not being buried, like fewer burials in the free part.
In the free area. Okay.
Yeah. So I was thinking either, yes, that's true, or, you know, maybe somebody was in charge of the church that was just a little bit less crazy about that, you know, but
like
I doubt
they lowered
it.
The rates on burials or something like that.
Like maybe they said, hey, let's just like unsegregate the cemetery and like bring everybody in. So
it's entirely possible. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's basically it from this study. There's a lot of really cool things in the Plos One article, and you can go read that. And they've got a lot of little charts and graphs if you're interested in that. So like I said, Plos One is a great source because the articles are open source. So you can pretty much see all the data that you want to read. And those links are in the show notes. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just mention a few things about Australia because these were early settlers in the 1840s. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about the settlement of Australia.
Yeah, because I was trying to think like, when did the settlement of Australia begin? Like, when did all of that happen?
Right. Well, pretty much everybody's at least heard that Australia is a land of convicts.
Right.
But what that means is a British settlement of Australia began really on January 26, 1788, exactly that day.
Okay.
And that's when a fleet of 11 ships carrying convicts and Marines, basically, and other support people landed at New South Wales. Now, New South Wales is an Australian state right now, but that's what Australia was called.
Was
New South Wales. The word Australia was not, so the continent wasn't called that.
Right, okay.
And country. this date, let me back up a little bit. So it was a penal colony. So they had convicts down there. They weren't going to leave. The first group was 1,000 people with more than 700 convicts on these ships. Okay. And at least 30 men died en route in the 8-month journey because you had to go around the Horn of Africa and get over. There was no Suez Canal.
They really wanted those convicts away from, away from Europe, didn't they?
Well, and I don't know if it was a secret desire of somebody to, or maybe not so secret, to try and colonize this land, but use convicts to do it. Because realistically, I mean, it's not like they went there and built a prison. They were just exiled there.
Living their lives. Right. Once
The captain who was in charge of the ship tried to get farmers and stuff to go along, and he tried to petition the government to have farmers and things like that come along, and they were just denied at every turn. And eventually, you know, the people that were there had to figure it out. And it was pretty rough for the first 10, 20, 30 years. They didn't know how to farm. They, you know, the crops kept failing. They just had to live. Again, they didn't build a prison. They were just told, you're here now.
Yeah.
If you want to live, you'll figure it out.
Figure out how to live.
Yeah.
Well, so it makes sense that the cemetery that they were excavating, they saw harsher effects on the body of poor nutrition and stuff like that earlier, and then it gets better later on as they get more prosperous, but like just learn how to cultivate food.
Right, and this was a colony that came 60 years after these settlers.
But
these guys would have experienced the same things, like you're saying. So anyway, it was just really rough, but they, you know, they knew they weren't leaving. They couldn't build ships and go, so this is where they lived. And the first anniversary of that, they actually celebrated that day. And then I think on the 30-year anniversary, it was a big celebration, a 30-year anniversary of the founding, basically, of the colony, which is, they're considering the founding of the country, essentially. And it became known as Australia Day today. And actually, I remember this because I have Australian colleagues with a company I'm working with, and they were like, oh yeah, we're not working, it's Australia Day. I was like, what the hell is Australia Day? And it should come as no surprise that the Aboriginal Australians actually call it Invasion Day.
Which makes total sense.
Total sense.
And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's just a little bit of information about Australia. And as I mentioned before, Australia actually means like Australia. It's like southern land.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, from a penal colony to Americans eating dogs in another colony.
Oh, boy.
I know. And it was 160 years before this, but we're moving over to Jamestown on the other side of the break. Welcome back to The Archaeology Show, our third and final segment of episode 167.
Are you sure you don't want to call it the British Colonization Show? Because
I mean, I really wasn't looking for a theme. They were just interesting artifacts. Articles?
Artifacts. Articles.
So they will be artifacts at some point.
Well, they're about artifacts in a lot of cases.
Yeah. I mean, that brings up kind of an interesting point. Are articles going to be artifacts? I mean, digital archaeology is a thing.
Oh, yeah.
And digital archaeology in the sense of recording digitally, like we talk about with WildNote and stuff like that.
Right.
But also the archaeology of digital things.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a whole science in itself. Are those called artifacts?
It kind of breaks my brain a little bit to think about it.
Yeah.
Because, like, are they? Is an article that was written in 1960 an artifact? It's not digital, but it's paper, right?
Well, right now, if it's in a paper magazine, the magazine is an artifact.
The magazine is an artifact, but it's the content also.
Well, it's, I mean, the content is the thing, though.
It is.
Yeah.
That's very complicated.
It is. It's all about the content, actually. The paper's not an artifact, but it is kind of.
Well, the paper is what is the artifact.
So like with a projectile point, if it wasn't shaped into a projectile point, it's just a billion-year-old rock at that point.
It's just a rock, yeah.
Yeah. All right, we're off the rails
now.
Yeah,
we are. We're veering, hard.
So there's an article at science.org called Jamestown Colonists May Have Kept and Eaten Indigenous American
Dogs. American dogs. Yeah. Okay, explain that, because...
Well, the word indigenous means... No, I won't explain that. So anyway, Jamestown Colony, the first permanent English colony in the United States, well, in what would become the United States, in the Americas. So that's what that is, full stop. Excavations at Jamestown that took place between 2007 and 2010. Now, there's been lots of excavations there. Yeah. This study focused on a collection that was excavated at that time. And this person was specific, or these authors were specifically looking at dog jawbones. Lots of things were found, of course, but they were interested in the dog remains.
Why would there be dog remains in with the other remains?
Right.
I would guess is what prompted them to look at this, right?
Well, what they're actually looking for is what is the ancestry of the dogs that were there in the remains, right? And we'll get to where they were found, but the bigger question was, what kind of dogs were they? Type,
did they bring them with them?
Yeah, I mean, the English had some pretty well-known breeds of dogs, and they're pretty strict about not crossbreeding. They love their purebreds, of course. I mean, that's still a thing.
Yeah.
But they brought very particular dogs to do very particular things. So did the Spanish when they came before that. And they brought, like, these war dogs that were just crazy. But they were bred for that purpose. But there were also dogs that were brought to the Americas about 16,000 years ago. And the only two of which remain today are the Malamute and the Alaskan Husky.
Yeah,
so those dogs are still considered ancient breeds. They're American ancient breeds.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, but in the lower 48, pretty much all ancient dogs were, you know, bred out or killed out at some point right around this time.
Okay.
So, but we never really knew what was going on there. But anyway, back to the study. We'll get to some of that in a minute. Anyway, this current study, they extracted mitochondrial DNA from the jawbones of these dogs. Okay, right?
That's cool.
Now, the interesting thing about where these were found, they were found with fish bones and mussel shells and other food stuffs in areas where people would be eating.
So kitchen trash, basically.
So kitchen trash. And they did have what evidence of what looked like butchering marks on them.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Well, I mean, you got to do what you got to do when you don't have food, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And interestingly enough, in other layers dating to about 10 years later, they found more of that. So it's not like they consistently found dogs in the food trash.
Oh, so it's related to specific times.
Specific stresses, really, because you don't generally eat dogs.
No.
Right.
Crazy. And the dog bones that they found that had cut marks on them were indigenous dogs as opposed to dogs that were brought over from Europe or somewhere else.
We'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah. So these were all dated so that just so they knew they had the right time period to the 17th century. And it may have been during the winter of, because they don't know exactly what date, but it may have been during the winter of 1609-1610, during a period of time with the Jamestown colony known as the Starving Time.
The Starving Time. Yeah. I mean, I've heard of that. Everybody's heard of that probably if you've done any research on Jamestown. It was a really tough winter, right? They had no food.
Yeah. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I'm actually kind of rethinking their conclusions, but the mitochondrial DNA, which looks down the mother's line, you know, of something, revealed that the Jamestown dogs were unrelated to European dogs, which again were first brought to the Americas by the Spanish in the late 15th century.
Okay.
And they were unrelated to any British dog breeds that we know of as well.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So
interesting.
I mean, they had literally no relation. They were instead most closely related to ancient dogs found in and around Illinois and Ohio around that time, and distantly related to ancient Arctic dogs, including a 10,000-year-old dog discovered in Alaska, considered the oldest dog in America.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how did those dogs end up with the Jamestown colony?
And here's another thing. The dogs were also not related to those found just 30 miles away in another excavation, which date to around 1000 to 1400 AD.
In the world? How'd they get there?
Yeah. So, I mean, here's the thoughts in the article are that they were not necessarily crossbreeding their dogs, but getting dogs from Native Americans, maybe through trade or something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
And I was kind of thinking, like, I mean, they're going to look around when they're hungry. They're not going to eat their dogs.
Yeah,
they're
going to
go find something
pets.
Else.
Right.
Yeah. You know that now if for some reason during the starving time they couldn't find any other animals to kill or things like that. I mean, if they're, you know, dogs like to stray around, and if they get away from their Native American counterparts, would they have just captured them and eaten them?
Well, stray animals can be a problem in a settled area, whether it's modern or historic. So maybe they had a stray dog problem going on, and you know, stray dogs meet starving times. Well, what are you going to do? You got to eat, you know? And if those strays are coming in from interactions with Native Americans, then that would explain why they were indigenous to the Americas rather than being brought over from Europe.
Right.
So, I mean, I can't imagine they put that much effort into bringing dogs over from Europe in the first place, because you have to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
A lot goes into bringing a healthy dog across the sea on a ship at that time.
Yeah.
So I wonder how many were even brought over to the Americas to begin with.
Well, I think, I mean, the way people love their dogs.
You know, somebody rich enough who could afford it.
They're not just pets.
Yeah, you know? True.
And I mean, like I said, the ancient dogs, the indigenous dog breeds, mm-hmm. were gone in an evolutionary instant with the arrival of European dogs. Now, I think personally, I didn't really read this in the article, but if you just think about why the dogs would have disappeared, right? Mm-hmm. Why the ancient dog breeds are now gone. I think it's probably tied to Native Americans being forced onto reservations because when we started to basically destroy their homelands and we wouldn't let their dogs breed with, you know, British dogs. Mm-hmm. I keep saying we, but Europeans and British settlers wouldn't have let their dogs breed with their dogs because, again, they valued the purebred nature of their dogs. So they're not going to let that happen. I'm sure it did happen, but they're not going to let it happen intentionally. So when Native Americans are... I mean, I hate to say it, killed off when there's war, when they're moved onto reservations later on, when things like that happen, I mean, they're not going to be able to economically and from a food standpoint be able to feed those dogs either.
Yeah.
You know, so they're just going to get, they're just going to die out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really the only plausible explanation for it because dogs are pretty ubiquitous. They will have sex at any point in time with any other dog.
Yeah, it's not like they were, you know, able to neuter or spay dogs back then either. So
of course not. Yeah, they didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, totally.
So, well, they did because there was like eunuchs in Greece, but either way.
Right, but it wasn't a common practice. So
Right. So that's the only thing I can think of. I didn't really read that in the article, but I was just thinking about that after I read it and took some notes on it. Mm-hmm. You know, that would make sense.
Yeah, the whole idea is very intriguing, though, to like look at the history of dogs and how I wish we could have David on here from Life and Ruins. He might know more than us, but like what's that history between the interactions of Native Americans with dogs and colonial settlers with dogs. It's just, that's an interesting intersection point to look at.
Well, there's definitely dogs depicted in rock art, Native American rock art.
Yep.
And mentioned in Native American folktales and things like that. So, they liked their dogs as much as much as any other culture.
Yep.
You know, so.
For sure.
Anyway, speaking of David with a Life and Ruins podcast, check out the Ethnocynology Instagram and TikTok accounts.
Yeah.
Because David is always doing some really good stuff out there. And ethnocynology is basically the study of dogs and culture.
Yeah. So, yeah. We'll link to it in the show notes. Yeah. But it's definitely cool if you're interested in dogs and humans and their interactions. Right. He talks a lot about that on his socials.
I never really thought about it. Ethnocynology. Ethno really means like ethnography, which is writing down and studying the culture of a thing. Mm-hmm. So ethnocynology, and cynology would be the study of dogs. Mm-hmm. Ethnocynology would be studying the culture and stories and how dogs related to, you know, humanity probably.
Yeah.
But I wonder if archaeocynology is really a thing, you know, where people just study like dog remains and dog stuff.
Maybe.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yep. All right. Well, that's about it. Kind of a couple short segments there, but they were fun news articles, so we wanted to talk about them.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
For members of the Archaeology Podcast Network, and if you're not a member, go to archpodnet.com/members. But for members, you can go to your member pages to the bonus content. We've got a fun little bonus segment for this episode for you to listen to. So
I'm worried because I don't know what this bonus segment is. I'm very concerned.
And also coming up in the next few weeks, we've got a bunch of different episodes. We actually have two interviews planned for later this month, and they'll probably play sometime in early May, early to late May. But one on an Egyptian Tutankhamun exhibit, which is pretty cool. And another interview with the author of a book called The First Black Archaeologist, The Life of John Wesley Gilbert. Mm-hmm. And we're currently reading that before the interview. So it's pretty cool. And those are going to be some fun ones. And we'll also have a, hopefully if we get our act together, a timelines episode. So anyway, check out our affiliate links. Check out the other podcasts on the APN. And if you're not a member and want to help us out, go to archpodnet.com/members. With that, we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.archpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.